Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. This weekend marks 500 days of the war in Ukraine. It is with that backdrop that leaders from 31 NATO countries will assemble in Vilnius, Lithuania, in what promises to be a pivotal summit for European security. This year's agenda is expected to focus on security guarantees for Kyiv, Sweden's accession, and NATO's evolving relationship with China. Here at FP, we've just published a series of short essays looking at the biggest issues facing NATO. You can find it on our homepage, and we've also included it at the top of our show notes. The authors include Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, who argues that if you want to prevent the next war in Europe, you need Ukraine in NATO. Other experts like Angela Stent, Liana Fix, Anne-Marie Slaughter, and others take on a range of issues from Russia after Putin to how to deal with China. One of the authors in the series is Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who argues that it's a mistake to not commit to admitting Ukraine into NATO. If membership isn't possible, he says, security guarantees are needed right away. Rasmussen was NATO's Secretary General from 2009 to 2014, and before that, Prime Minister of Denmark. He's also the founder of the Alliance of Democracies, and you'll hear us get into a bit of a tiff about that. As always, FP subscribers get to send in questions that frame these discussions. If you'd like to do that too, subscribe now. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. For now, let's get started. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, welcome back to FP Live.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with your essay in FP. You say the best path to admit Ukraine into NATO is by focusing on security guarantees in the short term, which you liken to U.S. military support for Israel. Expand on that.
It's important to understand that we need security guarantees regardless of all the discussions about future membership of Ukraine. Until Ukraine can join NATO, Ukraine will need security guarantees. Last summer, I prepared a set of proposals called the Kyiv Security Compact that I handed over to President Zelensky. The essence of it is to make Ukraine capable of defending itself, by helping Ukraine build a strong military, so strong that it can withstand any future Russian attack, by enhancing exchange of intelligence between Ukraine and its allies, by sustaining joint training and exercises under NATO and EU flag, and by building a strong Ukrainian defense industry so Ukraine can produce military equipment and ammunition itself. So that's the core of the Kyiv Security Compact.
You know, it strikes me that you've been saying it would be a mistake to not make commitments to Ukraine while the war is ongoing. But that position to not make commitments is the position of the current Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, as well as that of several member countries. So how do you square that? And aren't you worried about Russia perhaps exploiting differences between member states here?
Yeah, the worst thing that could happen at the Vilnius summit is a split within the alliance and a split between NATO and Ukraine. So I think first and foremost, we have to ensure that we keep the unity, the unprecedented unity we have seen within the alliance and across the Atlantic during the last couple of years. I think to square the circle, we would need three things. Firstly, to to offer Ukraine an accelerated path towards NATO membership, just like Finland and Sweden. Second, to establish a NATO-Ukraine Council with the task to determine exactly which conditions should be fulfilled for Ukraine to join NATO. And third, to review this question next year when NATO meets in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the 75th anniversary of NATO.
It seems to me there's some distance between what you are proposing and what, you know, currently seems to be the NATO consensus, especially given some of the divisions among member states. Now, you informally advise Ukraine's President Zelensky. Do you think he will be satisfied with what's currently on the table from NATO?
Well, negotiations are continuing until the very last minute, I think, next week, when we have the NATO summit in Vilnius. So we are not able to determine the final outcome yet, but I'm quite optimistic regarding security guarantees. It seems that a number of allies will sign a document, a kind of an umbrella under which individual allies can agree on bilateral security agreements with Ukraine. And in that respect, I'm quite optimistic. It remains to be seen how far we can go when it comes to the Ukrainian membership perspectives. But let me remind you that back in 2008, NATO decided that Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Now Ukraine has been in the waiting room for 15 years. So we have to go beyond the language from the NATO summit in Bucharest 2008. One possibility would be to say, okay, Ukraine does not need to fulfill the conditions in a membership action plan, it's called. It's somewhat technical, but it's the next step. It was decided in 2008, that's the next step for Ukraine. But we don't need that. We didn't require Finland and Sweden to join a membership action plan before we invited them. And actually, Ukraine has demonstrated in the battlefield that they fulfill all the necessary criteria. So I think we could do something when it comes to the membership perspective that would move beyond the 2008 decision.
But let me ask you this, given that a war is ongoing, could NATO ever realistically accept Ukraine as a full-fledged member if some of its territory is still occupied by Russia? And I ask this because, you know, Moscow has maintained breakaway states of sorts in Georgia and Moldova, which in a sense has made it so much harder for them to ever join NATO on paper.
Exactly. And that's a goal of Putin's many maneuvers, to keep his neighbors weak and dependent on the Kremlin and prevent them from joining the Euro-Atlantic structures, NATO and the European Union, by freezing conflicts in Georgia, as you mentioned, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and in Ukraine by taking Crimea and de facto occupying parts of the Donbas region. But listen, if we declare publicly that Ukraine cannot join NATO as long as the war is going on, we are de facto providing Putin with an argument to continue the conflict to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO. So my answer to your question is, yes, we could invite Ukraine to join NATO even if a war is still going on. Obviously, there would be practical issues to sort out, including how Article 5 could and should apply to a member state actually in war, but where there is a will, there is also a way.
I want to channel David McLaughlin and many of our other subscribers who are writing in just very quickly beyond potential accession, beyond the security guarantees. What else do you think will emerge next week for Kyiv? What else can Ukraine get out of NATO in terms of commitments?
Yeah, but first of all, the security guarantees will not be a NATO issue. It will be an issue between a number of individual allies and Ukraine. It will be led by the United States, joined by the UK, Germany, France, Poland, maybe others. And I would expect such a document to be signed in the run-up to Vilnius or at the sidelines of Vilnius. But it would be seen in the context of the Vilnius summit. Now, furthermore, I would expect some progress when it comes to Ukraine's NATO perspective. I cannot imagine just to repeat the language from 2008. That would actually be a big, big disappointment. We should not underestimate the strength of establishing a NATO-Ukraine Council. Today we have a NATO-Ukraine Commission. But to change that into a council actually elevates the status of Ukraine. Ukraine will then be a member with an equal status like the 31 NATO allies, which means that Ukraine can bring issues to the table, and Ukraine can demand meetings in this council. So I think those elements could be expected by Ukraine at the summit.
Hmm. Now, you know, as part of your work with the Kyiv Security Compact, which you co-wrote with Andrei Yermak in the Ukrainian government, I know you've been doing the rounds in Europe and the United States, shoring up support for Ukraine. You have got your finger on the pulse. And so I ask you, which NATO and Western countries do you think are experiencing donor fatigue in this moment? So in other words, which ones have domestic pressures that could prevent them from supporting Kyiv in the longer term?
Actually, I've been positively surprised to learn about the resilience, both in Europe and the United States, when it comes to continuing supporting Ukraine. But obviously, everybody is now watching the development in the United States as we are approaching elections next year. I think all that speaks in favor of pushing even harder to make sure that weapon deliveries and other kinds of assistance to Ukraine are accelerated so that we avoid to mix it up with the upcoming election campaign in the United States. The good news is, from my several visits to DC, where I spoke with both the administration and members of Congress, that there seems to be a broad bipartisan support for continuing the assistance to Ukraine. Apart from small minorities in both parties, there seems to be a broad bipartisan support for Ukraine and against Russia. I appreciate that, and I hope that will persist also next year when we are in a heated election campaign.
Well, I should just point out that the two main front runners for the GOP nomination, Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, have both often seemed dismissive of the war in Ukraine. I think DeSantis has called it a territorial dispute. So there are fears here in the United States. And I imagine because of that, in Europe, that U.S. support could dwindle especially if there's a change in leadership. But I want to ask you a question related to that, because just this morning, it's emerged that the Biden administration seems likely to allow cluster bombs to be delivered to Ukraine. And this is something that, you know, the U.S. has previously been against, partly because cluster bombs often leave duds behind, and those duds can hurt children after the fact. There are, you know, many human rights groups that are critical of the use of cluster munitions. Where do you come down on this? I mean, is part of what you're describing about this sort of desperation to win the war now, is that leading to decisions such as this one that could have other harmful ramifications?
Yeah, but let me be clear on cluster bombs. I don't like them. I don't like them. They are brutal weapons, and there is a reason why countries around the world have banned them. However, whether I support them or not, they have been used already by both sides in the war. The difference is Ukraine using them to defend its territory. Russia is using them as an aggressor. So it's understandable why the Ukrainians want those terrible weapons to defend themselves against a brutal aggressor. However, I think it underlines the need for delivering heavier weapons to the Ukrainians to really get the upper hand in the battlefield. Not only longer range missiles, heavy battle tanks, but also fighter jets. That's actually what the Ukrainians need most right now.
Indeed, and we've published an essay by Foreign Minister Kuleba on exactly that, about fighter jets. I want to talk about Turkey, because it often looms large every time there's a NATO summit. And the last time you were on FP Live, we spoke about this, and it seems to me there hasn't really been that much movement since then. So yes, Finland has joined, but Turkey was an obstacle then, and now it's once again proving to be a hurdle for Sweden's accession. How are you thinking about Turkey, especially with a Erdogan returning to power, rejuvenated? What kind of leverage does NATO have over him?
Yeah, all decisions in NATO are taken by unanimity. We need consensus whenever NATO takes decisions. That's both a strength and a weakness. It's a weakness because it may take endless times and efforts, not least by the Secretary General, to try to work out a sustainable compromise. But once we have achieved the consensus, it's also a strength, because the alliance moves in unity. As regards Sweden, I'm still optimistic. I think eventually we will get a decision that Sweden will join NATO, and I also foresee that it will happen in a not too distant future. Yesterday, there was a meeting at NATO headquarters, including Turkey and Sweden. A new meeting has been organized for Monday between Erdogan and the Swedish Prime Minister Kristersson. I hope that will bring sufficient progress so that Sweden can join as soon as possible. There may be some problems logistically about ratification in the Hungarian and Turkish parliament. But if a political decision could be taken at the summit in Vilnius, I would consider that a great success. I'm hopeful that might happen.
You know, many of our subscribers are also very interested in the Turkey issue. I just want to name check them: Robert Owen Friedman, Dora Loveva, Joshua. And one of their questions is, should there be talks to expel Turkey from NATO? Has this ever come up when you were Secretary General, or in the years since?
No, and I don't think it would be a wise decision to go down that road. Obviously, I'm also concerned about Turkey. I'm concerned about the purchase of Russian military equipment. I'm concerned about Erdogan's closing up with Putin. I'm concerned about the domestic political development in Turkey, the suppression of the opposition, lack of respect for rule of law, human rights, etc., etc. So we have a lot to be concerned about when it comes to Turkey. But having said all that, we also need Turkey as an ally, as a bridge between the East and the West. And I'm concerned that if we try to kick out Turkey from NATO, Turkey would be even more Eastern oriented and even less reform oriented. So I prefer to maintain what I would call a critical dialogue with Ankara. Also, because half of the Turkish population has shown in elections that they want political change. And I think we owe it to them to maintain the links with Ankara. By the way, NATO does not have any mechanism as to how we could kick out members. So it would be a very, very complicated process if we decided to do so. But I cannot recommend to go down that road.
So something you just said really stuck with me. You said we need Turkey, and that strikes me as realism, which is often in conflict with values. So I just want to talk about democracy a little bit more because you run a group called the Alliance of Democracies. NATO leaders often pride themselves in being an alliance of democracies. But what do you do then when your own member states, let's say Turkey or Hungary, when they exhibit clear signs of democratic recession? So what happens to NATO's values then? And how do you square that with the realism that you seem to be exhibiting right now?
I see your point, but
It's hard, I know.
I'm what I would call a realistic idealist, I think we should consider what would be the alternative if we kick out Hungary from the European Union, if we kick out Turkey from NATO. Would that improve the whole situation? Would that strengthen the Alliance of Democracies? My conclusion is no. And if we look at this in a helicopter perspective, then I think we have bigger fish to fry. We have seen how the world's autocracies have advanced during recent years. I think we have seen a decline in global freedom and democracy for the 17th consecutive year. That's the real challenge. So we have to improve the cooperation between the world's democracies to counter the world's autocracies. And in that respect, I consider Putin and Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un, Assad, bigger enemies than Erdogan and Orban.
But you know, I think I want to push you a little bit more on this because it strikes me as a divide between the rhetoric we often hear from leaders, and then the reality. So the reality, as you've just described it, often tends to be gray. It often tends to be realism or idealistic realism, as you put it right now. But then when you hear, say, President Biden, who has tried to align democracies against autocracies, which makes it sound much more black and white than the gray that you're describing, that sort of rhetoric, it often seems to backfire, I think, when he has to fist bump Saudi's MBS or when he's unable to call out India's Narendra Modi for problems with human rights or freedom of the press in India, or with Turkey, as you've just been describing quite honestly. So isn't there a problem then with groups such as NATO, with countries in the West that you know, talk in a certain way about democracies versus autocracies, but then when it comes to choosing between values and interests, end up choosing interests.
You're right. It isn't black and white, but I think basically we are approaching a new world order with two camps, an autocratic camp led by China and a democratic camp led by the United States. But in between, you have a gray zone. You have what I would call non-aligned democracies. India is actually a prominent example of that. And you have non-aligned autocracies like the Gulf kingdoms, for example. And we, the democratic countries, should invest much more efforts in anchoring, for instance, India firmly in the democratic camp, encourage them to cut ties with Russia, and providing India with weapons and what else they get from Russia right now. I think that is a realistic idealism to gang up against the autocrats and invest efforts in ensuring that some of the countries in the gray zone will be firmly anchored in the democratic camp. And still, I think this is much more important than going into details about Erdogan and Orban.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, so sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
So since we're talking about China, let's go there. Japan, South Korea, and Australia are attending the NATO summit this year. What kind of signal do you think that's sending to Beijing?
Yeah, but obviously it's sending a clear signal to Beijing that NATO, though it is a North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is also focused on what is going on in Southeast Asia. And of course, it is a clear signal to Beijing not to try to change status quo when it comes to Taiwan. I visited Taiwan at the beginning of this year, and they are preparing for all eventualities, and I understand them. And I think we should not repeat the mistakes we made with Putin. The US and Europe reacted much too mildly when Putin attacked Georgia and since then Ukraine. And he miscalculated that as a weakness he could exploit. I think we should be very clear with China and tell China in advance, if you dare to attack Taiwan, you'll meet severe consequences. We will help Taiwan militarily, and you will be exposed to sanctions. So I think to send that clear message to China in advance might deter China from attacking Taiwan and trying to change status quo.
The problem with sanctions on China, however, are, for example, what we've seen this week with China coming back with restrictions on gallium and germanium, two significant metals that go into the creation of semiconductors. China controls 80% of that market. China's not Russia. It's the second biggest economy in the world. And what I want to get to with this is that we were discussing earlier some of the differences among European countries when it comes to Ukraine. I would argue there are even greater differences among European countries and even NATO countries when it comes to China. So the US is probably the most hawkish, but France has often made the case for strategic autonomy. President Macron even took dozens of CEOs with him on a visit to Beijing. And then you have Eastern European countries, which certainly need China more than richer European countries do. So aren't you worried about Beijing exploiting these differences?
Yes, you're quite right. China is another beast than Russia. We are much more dependent on China. But I think it's a reminder that we should reduce our dependence on autocratic countries. So, for instance, when it comes to semiconductors, we should as fast as possible build up our own capacity. And we should extract rare earths and critical minerals at a much higher pace than we have done in the past. We cannot reduce our dependence on Russian oil just to get addicted to Chinese rare earths and critical minerals. So we have a great challenge, but I think even in Europe, you have seen, even in Europe, China's behavior is an eye-opener. And you have seen a lot of European steps like de facto banning Huawei by a new EU Commission proposal to strengthen what we call economic security, including investment screening mechanisms, stricter export controls, etc., etc. So Europe is actually following suit.
I hear you on that. I guess the question I was trying to get at is, isn't there a risk of overreach on NATO's part since it's a security alliance? Isn't there a risk that Beijing will in turn react in ways that won't help NATO or Europe? Isn't there a risk that a lot of what NATO's trying to do right now, if it is overreach, that it could backfire, just given how different Asia is than Europe, given how some of the non-aligned countries you described in Asia, India and Indonesia, they're on the fence when it comes to the war in Ukraine. When it comes to China, they're far more conflicted.
Yeah. And we should not forget that NATO is an abbreviation of North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So NATO will remain focused on the North Atlantic area. However, the US, Canada, and certainly, and definitely also France consider themselves Pacific nations. And that's why NATO is now focused on the security challenges from China. But I don't foresee an active NATO engagement as such in military conflicts in and around the South China Sea or between China and Taiwan. However, I think the US would expect important NATO allies to be helpful if it came to a military conflict between the US and China. And definitely, I think to deter China from moving in that direction, it is important that NATO allies discuss it so that China knows in advance there is a clear risk if they engage in military adventures.
Yeah, I hear you, and that deterrence is a big part of this. Since we're spanning the globe, another one of our subscribers, Tim Reed, had a great question. He says, Africa is an area of great interest in NATO because of security, migration, economic interests. Yet it has been increasingly mishandled, he says, by member states as they have supported dictators and warlords across Africa. So this has opened the door wide to actors like Wagner and China. How should NATO adapt when it comes to Africa policy?
Yeah, I think the West should be much more focused on the African continent. The fact is that China has invested heavily in Africa. And China does not ask critical questions about human rights. They deliver money, they deliver investments, but in exchange, they extract minerals, for instance, which are then brought to China to be further handled and produced. They do not create jobs in Africa. And I think in Africa, more and more people are aware of that. We've all seen how Russia has increased its military engagement. You mentioned the Wagner Group as an example, that's right. And actually, I think the values of the West are much closer to the basic interests of the African people. But we have left it to China and Russia to engage in Africa. So I think we should invest much heavier politically as well as economically in Africa. By the way, also in Latin America, that's actually the exact same problem.
Well, now that we've spanned the globe, I just want to bring us back to Russia and the war in Ukraine in our final few minutes. So it's been 2 weeks now since the Wagner rebellion. Do you think there's still a threat to Putin's stranglehold on power?
Yeah, I think Putin has been significantly weakened by the mutiny of the Wagner group. Now, it's mysterious where Prigozhin, he resides right now. And we don't know the full content of the deal between Putin, the Belarusian dictator Lukashenko, and Prigozhin. I think the whole affair has weakened Putin, which also add a quite new perspective to the whole strategic perspectives of the war in Ukraine. I think so far, Putin has calculated that time was on his side. I think the conclusion now is it's not necessarily on Putin's side. He thought he could outlast Europe and the US by our populations being tired of war, tired of continued assistance to Ukraine. But now he has to realize that the longer the war drags out, the bigger the risk of fragmentation and conflicts within the Russian society. So now the war, the time is not necessarily on Putin's side. That's a big strategic change.
Hmm. I know you speak with senior Ukrainian officials very often. Are you able to tell us whether they are at all disappointed by the counteroffensive so far and what it's been able to achieve? Are you at all disappointed?
I think we have to be realistic that our hesitation to deliver heavy weapons to the Ukrainians in due time has made the counteroffensive very complicated, much more difficult than we had expected, because Putin has exploited our hesitation to fortify the Russian defenses in the occupied territories. So it just underlines the need to deliver to the Ukrainians all the weapons they need as fast as possible. I've never, ever understood why we have self-imposed restrictions on our weapon deliveries. We should have used the big hammer right from the start. We have a clear interest in putting this conflict to a quick end.
Well, almost in answer to your question of why there's been hesitation, one of our subscribers, Gloria Renner, has a question, and she says that desperation may trigger Putin's use of nuclear weapons. Aren't you worried about Putin lashing out, or the nuclear issue, or what's going on in Zaporizhia?
No, I'm not concerned about the nuclear issue. I don't think Putin dares to push the nuclear button. First of all, because the Russian military knows very well that if they were to use nuclear weapons, it would have devastating consequences for the Russian military. Because the response from the United States and its allies would be very harsh. And the rest of the world will turn its back to Russia, including China and India. An attempt to use nuclear weapons would be the end of the Putin regime. So for that reason, he will not use nuclear weapons. So I'm not concerned about his use of nuclear weapons. Having said that, I would also stress we should never, ever give in to nuclear blackmail. Those who surrender to nuclear blackmail are condemned to live in eternal slavery under the whip of the nuclear master. So we should never, ever accept that kind of threats.
There have been reports that former senior U.S. officials quietly met with Russian officials for back-channel talks on Ukraine. I don't know if you know about them, but let me ask you this. Would you engage in track 1.5 or track 2 diplomacy with Russia at this point?
I don't know anything about it. I saw the reports. I have no knowledge about it. But in my opinion, it's naive. In the best case, it's really naive. And it can only be used by the Russian propaganda. I think what we have one thing to do, it is to help the Ukrainians with all the weapons they need to kick out the Russians from Ukrainian territory. The Ukrainians have the will to fight. And if we give them the means to fight, they have a fair chance to retake lost land.
And as for Rasmussen, it's a pleasure to have you on again.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that was Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former Secretary General of NATO. Next week, AI and geopolitics. We'll have Paul Share, who wrote the cover essay of FP's summer print issue, The Scramble for AI. You will not want to miss this one. Remember, subscribers can submit questions in advance and help frame these discussions. Sign up on foreignpolicy.com and use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That's it for this week. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters. the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an Everyday Ambassador, coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.